LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Kingsley Dennis, who joins us to discuss The People of the Secret, a 1983 book by Ernest Scott. A comet crosses the sky and furrows the Earth and human consciousness with energy of its passing. Asteroids collide and scatter their substance across the heavens. On Earth, a continent sinks, an island reemerges from the ocean. A desert becomes a new sea. A fertile land becomes a desert. Nations, whole races, rise, decline, and disappear, leaving only legend to mark their place and their passing. All accident, all arbitrary thrust and collision of blind forces signifying nothing, or all purposeful and intentional, having reason and significance within some present moment vastly greater than we can imagine. This is The People of the Secret. Hello and welcome, Kingsley, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Cheers, Greg. It's good to be here, and especially for such an interesting topic that we have to talk about today.
Indeed. Now, I'm going to dispense with the usual potted bio for guests, which is something that I usually do. We've spoken together many times over the years. People will find links to all of those interviews on the program page for this show, and whatever platform people are listening on, in the show notes there's a link to your website. People can just click through if they want to know about your background and the rest of your work. Today we're going to be discussing a book. People will probably have seen the graphic already here. The book's entitled The People of the Secret. This was published in 1983 on the Octagon Press, which is interesting in itself. Author Ernest Scott, that may or may not be the author's real name. Now, we're going to say take a deep dive into the content of the book here, and I will say something in a moment, sort of headline comments about overarching themes and, sort of the blurb on the back of the book type stuff, as it were. But before we do that, what I'd like to know is how you first came upon the book. What the context was, and if there's any serendipity around that. I'll let listeners know that the reason I'm talking to you about this book in particular is because I can't remember now. It was only a few months ago this book was mentioned in something I was reading or listening to or whatever, and it sounded intriguing. And then the next day, less than 24 hours later, you mentioned it. I don't know if it was in one of your perspectives videos, in something that you put out, you mentioned the book. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is serendipity. This, my attention is being drawn to this book. And that's when I went out and got a copy. It took a bit of doing because it's very rare. So just tell us how you first came upon it.
Well, I'm looking at my copy now, and I've got the date in 95. So I tend to date my books because it gives me a kind of record of my own kind of research line. So that's 95. And I think the main thing I came across it was, as you mentioned, it's published by Octagon Press, which is an interesting publishing house, which was set up by Idris Shah. And so I came to this book, I think, from that kind of angle, is that I'd been reading stuff of Shah, and I this had been mentioned, I think, by other books published by Octagon Press. And although at that time, they were fairly easy to get hold of, even so, the book was published in 83. So it was still like after 20 years afterwards that I picked up a copy. And I read it at the time, and it just kind of, blew me away, really. And I can say that in the intervening years, I know that I've read the book from cover to cover at least three times. And every time I read it, it's just brings up a whole wealth of information. And what I did also is that there's so many references to other works in the book. The book is a walking library. And what I did was I kind of followed all the references in the book and then found those books themselves. So I kind of worked from this book and I keep coming back to it. So it was, yeah, around 95. And I think also at the same time, I was also in into the Gurdjieff work, you know, George Ivanovich Gurdjieff. And his work is in the book as well, and there's a crossover. So I think that's how I came to it, through the Gurdjieff research, through Octagon Press, and it was mentioned, and yeah, so that was, I say, about nearly 30 years ago now.
Okay, so the recorded intro that I've done for this is a little bit enigmatic, deliberately so, because I wanted to kind of pique listeners' interest and not give too much away. But we talk about headline themes here. Somebody said, "Oh, what's this book about?" A couple of the main themes I would say in response to that question would be perennial wisdom, the idea that there is an ancient, wisdom within the human race and our history that may have been partially, if not completely, lost to most of the species, something that has informed our journey over the millennia, who knows how long. But the idea that something that is preserved by almost a monk-like class, or an elite, or something that's carried through the ages, and that it perhaps rises and falls in human consciousness at different times. So it's the idea of the perennial wisdom, and that's a phrase that comes up in a lot of mysticism and spiritual traditions, through Freemasonry and Arthurian legends. It's peppered in all sorts of places where, and hinted at, shall I say. And often presented, in mythic terms and in allegory. So there's that idea. And there's also the idea, I mentioned this elite class with sort of this privileged information. It's the idea of a secret government, a sort of behind the scenes secret unknowns. And that can be a positive thing. It can be a negative thing, depending on your view. It can be a mixture of both. But it's just the idea of, people we don't know who are behind the scenes, or above and beyond the people who appear to be pulling the strings in the world. So those are just kind of twin ideas that I would draw out. I mean, what would you say? You're sitting on a train, you're reading the book, someone on the seat opposite says, "What's that about, mate?"
Well, yeah, what's that about, mate? And that's how do you answer that in a elevator pitch? What I would say is that for me, the book represents what I would call a meta history. And I think the important aspect of the book is that it gives the whole sweep of the bigger picture of how historical waves and incidents are woven together. So, being a meta history means that it's not just looking at the history that we know of, such as the rise and fall of religions and the rise and fall of cultural movements, but it gives the pauses and connections beyond historical context. And that's why the book talks about the gestation, the birth, and the death of cultural phenomena and cultural epochs. But that behind these flow, ebb and flow of cultural epochs, there's a kind of, to use a laden word, a design. There's an intentional impulse seeded into cultural historical events, so they're not random. And if you step back, you can see that the course of human cultural evolution and the course of human psychological conscious evolution has been directed by forces beyond our historical framework. That's what I would say.
Yes, and we'll come to detail on that proposition, that idea, in due course. Talking about changing times and changing views of reality and time and space and consciousness and events What you mentioned about intentionality and design, we do seem to have had some positive evolution along those lines since the time that the book was published, and indeed even since the time that you first bought and read the book. Now, obviously, we find ourselves in quite a predicament at the minute as a species, a lot of things going haywire in the world, but still, in some of the areas that we're interested in, you know, the evolution of consciousness, there is positive movement. And it was interesting reading the introduction in the book here, written by Colin Wilson, yeah, the Colin Wilson, you know, the celebrated author who's, for so many of us, was an important part of our journey, you know, of ideas and approach to reality. He mentions David Foster's 1975 book, The Intelligent Universe, which I only found out about a couple of years ago and found an old hardback copy of that. But he mentions that the ideas there of intelligence and design in the cosmos as a quote unquote extreme view. And he wasn't meaning that in a pejorative way. He was just kind of acknowledging the reality at the time, I think, and just saying, well, look, this is a lot of people will, you know, read books like this and just think this is out there. And I think we've moved on a lot since then. So the reason I mention this is because I think now's a very good time. It was a good time for me to come to the People of the Secret. And I think for a lot of people listening to this who are interested in the areas that we're talking about, maybe followers of your work or, you know, legalized freedom and interest in some of these overarching themes, it might be, you know, just the time for them to discover this, whatever age they happen to be.
Yeah, I think it's important now because having a kind of perspective beyond the normal context or confines allows us to see and perceive that the events that we live through are not just the events we perceive them, that they're part of a much larger arc of movement. And so it gives us kind of, I think it gives us hope and to realize that you know, we are not just at the whim of random forces operating through the world that pushes hither and thither, like flotsam and jetsam, but we are actually part of a much grander evolutionary arc. And so that has intelligence in there and is recognizing human intelligence. And so I think that puts us way beyond, let's say, the antics of geopolitical events and the selfishness of human actions. So I think that's important to recognize that we are part of an intelligent cosmos. Of course, on the negative side, I think because what we're going through at these times and the selfish behavior of certain kind of elite groups, it may seem also elitist to think that there's this, you know, quote unquote secret government or secret group, the people of the secret, a secret group of higher intelligences, because that can smack of a kind of, you know, a back door into controlling humanity by making us believe that these are the good people. But of course, that I think that's because we've been conditioned to be very suspicious of elitist groups. So the people of the secret, I would say, are not elitist groups because that gives a false impression of a kind of hierarchical nature. What I say is that they represent a certain quarters or certain aspects that there are entities of grand intelligence beyond human individual intelligence. In fact, in the beginning of the book, as we'll come to, these are kind of almost a demiurgic intelligence. And that demiurgic intelligence is operating on the planet. It's not an elitist hierarchical thing. They do have representatives. But it's a kind of, I mean, the only true democracy really is a spiritual democracy in the sense that you understand and you receive things according to your capacity. You don't have a social class, a political class or anything. It's things unfold according to your capacity to perceive them. And so it's up to you to work on that capacity. So once we understand that, I think we can see that there are beneficial forces much larger and beyond humanity that have an interest in the correct unfoldment of life on this planet. And this book, I think, gives us a glimpse into some of their operations.
Yes, that bigger picture that you mentioned is so important, and we're enjoined to sort of to take that view or try and take that perspective if we can by many, you know, writers and thinkers, you know, in this age and in others as well, but particularly now to say, you know, if you zoom out and look at things from that sort of bird's eye view, then yeah, it doesn't change the negativity, you know, of current events on Earth. But that perspective, you can then see it within that larger context. It's a bit like, to mention Colin Wilson again, he had mentioned the bird's eye view as opposed to the, I think it was a worm's eye view. And if you're that earthworm, what you're seeing crawling along there in the dirt, if you think that's all of reality and all of the world, well, it's going to be pretty dismal. But you're a mile in the sky, and it's like, whoa, okay, now I see the context within which this is set. And I think that because of our in our modern age, in the materialist age, human lifespans being what they are, and the sort of how we're encouraged to pursue material things and to essentially be selfish, that in itself can consume people. And it's like, well, you know, I can't take this bigger view. I'm focused on, you know, you kind of that idea of like you've got to enjoy yourself while you're here type thing. And it can be hard, you know, like the, you know, the people who built the pyramids and the people who built the Gothic cathedrals, you know, generations beginning a project knowing they'd never see it finished, but they contributed to the, you knew that that project was ongoing. And I feel a little bit like that in my life, is that, you know, I've got some small part to play, and you do, and everyone listening to this, whether they're conscious of it or not, have some part to play in the human journey that has gone on for millions of years, and we trust will continue for a long time as well. And it can seem futile, can't it? You say, well, what can I do? And, you know, I'll be dead soon. I mean, how often have we heard that type of attitude when it comes to problems in the world?
Yes, and I think that's you. I think you're right there. That's a symptom of kind of modernity in these times, whereby, you know, we've been conditioned to focus on the smallness of a human life, and you know we come and go within a blimp of a evolutionary eye, and so it makes us think that we have nothing to contribute because, you know, there's very little we can leave behind, and that's mainly because you know we've been, you know, surrounded and programmed in by so much materialism and the materialistic path. And of course, if we adhere to that, it also feeds in and supports the, you know, the kind of whatever the status quo that benefits from a belief in materialism, and that benefits a certain kind of control hierarchy. Whereas, of course, by having this longer term view, I see it as a much more organic perspective, which human civilizations used to hold, as you said, rightly so, from the Egyptian times. The humanity had a much larger, you know, sense of their place in the cosmos, whereby what they do now participates for the longer journey of humanity, and so everything has meaning and purpose in this larger evolutionary trajectory. And so it also, I think, it strengthens us to realize that we are putting in something that will always be there. But I think that sense of this, the majesty of the human journey on and the planetary evolution together, has been, you know, has been kind of dismantled by especially scientific materialism and the rationalistic structures and the control structures that we have, and that magic's been taken away. And as you pointed out, the great Colin Wilson wrote a wonderful introduction. And also, it's on the back blurb of the book. And I love the line when he says, I'll read it here. He says, if its author had been born a few centuries ago, he would have been burned for heresy. But his real crime would not have been in expressing heterodox and dangerous ideas, but in expressing them so brilliantly and persuasively. I think it's a very good kind of line to put by saying, of course, you know, in some quarters, these ideas would have been dangerous and you would have been burned. But it's not because of the idea, but because they express so well. And which means that I think that any reader can come to this book with an open mind. And even if you don't agree with the thesis, you know, that there is this people of the secret who are guiding humanity, you may think, no, I don't believe with that. That's not my perspective. You can still read the book and come away with gaining so much because the ideas and the contents are so persuasively and beautifully and clearly expressed. So I don't think the author of the book is trying to persuade you into this thesis. They're presenting it. And it's up to you whether you want to take it on board. But if not, then at least you can bring away a lot more things from it. And just to finish, I think the book was The book was able to be released more or less now. Of course, it was, 83. But what I mean is that the reason why the book is so persuasive is because it's not a hypothesis in a vacuum. Everything in the book is backed up by real life sources. And that's why I said it's like a walk-in library, because so many things are referenced, whether it's philosophy, science, mysticism, mythology, esoteric matters, normal history events and history books are all cited. So what the book is trying to say is that the book was waiting to be written when the material was there to back it up, to support it. And all the supporting material is out there in the world today. You can go and find it. So the hypothesis is interwoven with the resources which have already been delivered into our cultures, and the books and the material and whatever else, the architecture, the buildings, the cultures, it's all there. And so it's not a, like I said, it's not a hypothesis in a vacuum. It's shown you through so many sources that which makes it the persuasive argument. And that's why I think that whatever your perspective, you can read it and bring something away from it.
Yeah, I think even if you remain a, hardcore materialist, after reading the book, as you say, it's there's nothing in there that's kind of an insult to even a scientific mind. It is, as you say, grounded and referenced, not just logically argued, but as you say, in a very literary style, very, very persuasive, but not in a not like a sales pitch. You mentioned the elevator pitch earlier. It's not like that. It's so unlike many books that people might categorize this with. It really is, quite unique in that respect. There's a number of books through my life that I've read that have either put me on a new path or put me back on the path that I feel that I'm supposed to be on. And this book came on the back of, published last year, John Michael Greer's Occult Philosophy Workbook. Now, that's just something that he's designed. It's basically, grounded in perennial wisdom, and that's something that you're supposed to work through in the course of a year if you wish to explore some of these ideas. But I read it cover to cover for the purpose of an interview, and it really was, it was like another reset, if you know what I mean, for me, like a or like topping up, as it were, with a sort of fuel of consciousness. And this book did exactly the same thing. That's one of the reasons why it felt so significant, because I thought, well, it's only a 6 months ago since I read something that made me feel like this again. And with The People of the Secret, as with the occult philosophy, whichever book he used to explore those ideas, the perennial wisdom, if it makes sense of, or seems to make sense of, or at least allows for an explanation of so many things that seem inexplicable or bizarre and impossible, whether it's events in the world or just the nature of reality. If you read something that says, well, hang on a minute now, if we allow for this, then all of these things that were confounding and confusing and they begin to fall into place. For me, that equals kind of a significance. So when I read The People of the Secret, it did that in spades, time and time again, chapter after chapter. It's like, yes, okay, so allow for what's being said here, what's being argued, what's being suggested, and see the pieces in the kaleidoscope begin to settle into a pattern that makes sense.
Yeah, so true. And like you said, it's so necessary these days to have some kind of larger context or framework in which to view what's going on in the world, because otherwise it'll get very kind of depressing seeing the chaotic madness that's going across the world. And that's why a few months ago or 3 months ago, I did mention the book again in the perspectives video, which you say you picked up on. It's because I was talking about the events of these times. And I went back to The People of the Secret, and I read a section from it, from I think chapter two, because the first two chapters are this big overview of how it's framing this kind of hypothesis. And so I did that because I wanted also to give myself and anyone listening a kind of larger picture framework to say, well, we have history that's unfolding across the world right now. We have versions of that history which is being filtered through certain biased and propaganda mechanisms. But if we can step back and see things as part of meta history and the larger unfolding, that these events are not isolated, but part of a kind of intelligent unfolding, despite how disagreeable they may seem at this particular point, then I say it helps to give us a framework. And I think that's why it's important for us to be discussing this book right now, because we are deliberately being withheld a larger framework of seeing what is the meaning and purpose of the human journey. Because, without having that framework, we get pulled into the smaller details of fear, anxiety, uncertainty, which obviously plays into the whole status quo of our malleability as people. So I think we owe it to ourselves in whatever form, not just through this book, but as you mentioned, there's other occult philosophies, perennial traditions, but try to provide ourselves with this larger framework so we have references which we can pin on the smaller historical events that are happening, and so we can retain that kind of comprehension of the necessity of the human journey and not be pulled down any false avenues. So yes, so I think it's timely, even though the book's been around for 30 years, that it's really helping events of today.
Now, what we've been talking about the last few minutes really, I would say, describes our predicament, a word that I used a few minutes ago, where we find ourselves in the world at the moment as a species and all of the problems with which we are beset, self-generated problems for the most part. Modern materialism, certainly that as a context, it is very destructive. It's not to deny material reality or to say that the material world is completely unimportant. We exist within it. We operate in it in waking reality, and it is to be paid attention to. But I think when that becomes all there is, then we have another predicament, which is not only a kind of, how can I put it, a yearning for meaning and purpose in existence that we undeniably have, but we just, for a lot of people, they can't articulate it, or they suppress it, or it's unacknowledged in themselves, because again, we're told that there can be no meaning, there is no meaning, no purpose, there cannot be, whether it's in human life, the world, or in the wider cosmos, it's denied. So therefore, a lot of people don't even start down that path, and may go through the entirety of their lives missing something, just with this gap in their soul and in their consciousness, and not knowing what to do about it, and being told actually, well, if you pursue material things, the good life, that's the best that you can hope for. Get these things, whether it be a career, a marriage, house, car, holidays, whatever it happens to be. These things are in fact represent meaning in the modern age. Or of course, there's a lot of pseudo spirituality. There's a lot of gurus out there and a lot of people offering to various paths, wisdom, this, that, and the other thing. Rather, too many of them are like weekend things, something that you do after work. And we're encouraged to pursue these. Religion in the modern era, well, actually for many centuries, kind of fulfilled this function in a way, that people go to church on Sunday or whatever it happened to be, for people's respective religion, whatever faith path they were on. And of course, when that was went away throughout the 20th and into the 21st century again, it was like, well, that left, rather than it being the hoped for reign of rationality that materialists, Richard Dawkins of this world hoped for, it seemed to leave just hollow out, an even bigger void in people's lives. So I would add to all of that a kind of physical dimension, in the sense of we think about this in terms of perennial wisdom and occult philosophy. It's just the limit of our own senses. We exist in this, for the most part, in this three-dimensional world, and we have our five senses, our ways of gaining information about the environment. Why do we even think that the human brain, for example, is capable of comprehending the cosmos? And this is where we find now, with science reaching an impasse, and it's another one of these temporal markers, I think, in our age, of something's got to give, because science promised, when religion went away, science will come rushing in, all the questions will be answered, it's only a matter of time before we have ticked all the boxes. But the more that science has, well, any field of human endeavor, actually, but the more that science itself has probed reality, the more bizarre and inexplicable it has become. Hence, this impasse. And in fact, we could say, and I'll finish on this point, that science has kind of revealed the unscientific. I use the word unscientific in its own terms. You only have to look at quantum physics, quantum mechanics, to see this. Even Einstein was repulsed by some of his own conclusions.
Yes, Greg. Indeed, I mean a lot there, and also we can add to that is that in these times there's a lot of fragmentation and division, both through through ignorance and also through deliberate intentions, and that division is taken us away from where the essence of where we need to focus on, and I think the book helps us to see that what we may think as being oppositions are often working together through social cultural events. I'm just opening the book now, and in the contents, for example, chapter number three is called The Inner Alliance, Rome, Christianity, and Islam. And chapter four is called The Vehicles, the Jewish Kabbalah, the Tarot, and Nostradamus. Number five is called Love Courts, Troubadours, and Round Tables. So what we've seen is that these, whether we think the religions are in opposition, such as Islam and Christianity, whether we think that these cultural or spiritual movements like the Tarot and the Kabbalah and the Nostradamus work, that they're all not connected, they're all separate or even opposed to one another, this book makes clear that that's not the case. That, as the chapter says, it's called the Inner Alliance. That there are alliances on an inner level, or let's say an esoteric level, or a dimension which is not so visible or knowable, whereby a lot of these aspects are kind of coordinating, but also there's elements within each one that are working together to put impulses and cultural drivers in certain ways that are for the benefit of all. And so there is this kind of inner agreement or inner understanding that these different aspects across the world, different cultural backgrounds, etc., may seem in opposition and may be used in opposition on an exoteric level, but in an esoteric level, there's a lot of kind of agreement and coordination, and going on. So that also helps us to understand. And also, I think that the book talks about that. The book is trying to explain to us that humanity hasn't always had, the knowledge or the capacity to see these bigger pictures, but it's time to understand it. And it's almost the book feels like it's a helping hand, a helping hidden hand, you could say, by saying, certain alliances need to be now kind of understood because we are at a critical impasse, a critical time where intelligence, human intelligence, needs to move forward. In fact, very, very directly, it says in chapter two, which we can come to, that says that an operation, a grand operation, was put into motion to increase the gravity of human consciousness over centuries. There's a movement whereby we need to kind of we can what I'm trying to say is that I think we can start to participate in this rather than just being unparticipatory or unconscious actors. We now have the capacity of intelligence to understand to some degree of these larger movements and to some degree to participate in it through our own inner understanding and intelligence.
Yeah, as we've hinted at here, and you've just laid out specifically, this is something, what the book has come or came at a particular time for a particular reason. This sort of intervention, if we can call it that, from whatever form this intellect or intelligence takes or form of consciousness in human affairs, this has happened time and time again. Each occasion kind of appropriate to the age, as it were. It takes different forms in the way that some people have said that when they've looked at the UFO or the UAP phenomenon, that this is a contemporary form of some kind of manifestation that has been perhaps chariots of fire or angels or whatever, in millennia gone by. So in the same way that this information comes to us, however it does, these ideas, this impulse, in a form suited to the age. And particularly, there's been times, and they've occurred routinely in the past, where on this evolutionary journey, this path, things have taken, have deviated too far, or the whole project, if I can call it that, is kind of somehow threatened. And then there's this intervention, sometimes more explicit, sometimes implicit, but very clear for those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. And in terms of our age, certainly this book being published in 1983, well, that's nothing. As far as the grand sweep of time that we're talking about, 1983 is now. Looking at the book now is more or less the same as looking at it in 1983, except perhaps what I said earlier, that things have continued to move on. And in fact, the book's very prescient in that sense, in setting the stage, for what's occurring, because there have been positive developments since that time, as I mentioned, but also the negativity has been heightened and hyped, so everything on across the spectrum of human affairs on the earth is just that much more intense than it was even in 1983.
Yes, I mean, like any good kind of resource, it's kind of has a long, longevity to it, and it's as if this book was put out before, but obviously to serve the future as much or even more than the time it was put out. So yes, and so it is, I think, necessary to see this, and also when you say the phrase, there are these huge, let's say, intelligent interventions into the life of humankind. Automatically, I've noticed, this word kind of puts people at an unease. The sense that there's this huge intervention, because, of course, I think intrinsically, humanity, we don't want to feel like we are under the auspices of a greater entities or gods, or because we've seen all those movies of the Greek gods and Jason the Argonauts and those kind of movies where you see the gods up beyond on Mount Olympus kind of moving us around and you think I don't want to be part of an intervention, but I think that's because we've got the wrong impression and it's time to re kind of recalibrate that impression. If we understand that life on this planet is a part of a much grander cosmos, and there are patterns and mechanisms of unfolding within the cosmos through the unfolding of intelligence, then, as you say, there are times when perhaps we go off course and have been off course, and maybe interventions and a steersmanship has been necessary to make sure that we reach certain thresholds at certain times. So it still means that we have our sovereignty as human beings, but also I think it makes us realize that we are part of a grander evolutionary pathway or trajectory, and we should honor that, not feel like, oh, I don't want to be under the auspices of a some other intelligence, and you reject that. We are part of a whole cosmic, kind of, layers within layers, and when we understand that, it does help us, I think, to have a an in inspiring view of the great unfoldment of life. So, I think once we get past our cultural conditioning and filters, then we can take a lot away from that.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.